come across people who will privately tell me that there needs to be change and so on. But no one wants to be part of that change. Nobody wants to stick their neck out. Nobody wants to go out there and say, hey, I, as a school principal, as an educator, as an official in the government, I think DEI training sessions are garbage. Here in Canada, there's a term that keeps coming up over and over again. There's a culture of fear, culture of fear. I keep hearing that over and over again. And I'm actually very tired of hearing that term. I think it's a culture of cowardice.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Rupa Subramania. Rupa, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brendan. It's great to be back.
It's wonderful to have you back on. And of course, I want to talk to you about Canada. Canada is where you're based, where you write, where you podcast, where you do everything you can to hold back the tidal wave of insanity that we're all experiencing these days. So I've got a lot of questions to ask you about the things you've been writing and the things you've been saying. And I want to kick off just by asking how Canada might be changing, because the last time I had you on the pod, we had a really good discussion about the Canadian truckers uprising, which listeners will remember, even though I'm sure some people would like to memory hole it. And this was, of course, a huge working class revolt against Justin Trudeau's regime, Justin Trudeau's government, which was trying to cajole truck drivers into submitting themselves to COVID interventions that they didn't want to have. There was a huge fallout. Listeners will remember that the Trudeau government used extreme authoritarianism against the truckers. They were widely demonized in the media. And I just wanted to kick things off on where Canada is at right now. I wanted to ask you what impact you think that event had. Did it have a lasting impact on how people view the government there? Did it have a positive impact? What's the aftermath of that moment like in Canada?
Brendan, I mean, that's a great question. A question that I've been thinking about quite a bit in recent weeks as well. It had an impact in the sense that finally Canadians who are seen as being very compliant people, they're very compliant. They follow all the rules and they don't are not seen as fighting back in the same way as their neighbors to the south. For the first time, they, made their voices heard and they protested for 3 weeks in the bitter cold. And it was an event that caught everybody's attention across the world. So this was very unusual for Canada. I'd like to think that there was some kind of an awakening where people were just tired of government overreach and that they were not going to put up with that any longer. But, you know, I tend to be a little pessimistic because there's a lot of government overreach that's been happening since the protests. So the Trudeau government passed this very, very problematic bill called Bill C-11, which essentially tells streaming platforms like YouTube and Netflix to include Canadian content. Now, nobody can define what Canadian content is. And what this ends up doing is that it's now become law. It became law in March. And what this ends up doing is that it basically, deprioritizes Canadian content in the rest of the world because this is how the algorithms work. And so it's been seen by a range of content creators, people who depend on streaming their videos, their content on YouTube, and their revenue stream depends on that. Many of them have threatened to move to the U.S. because they can't earn a living here as a result. So there's another problematic bill which also became law called Bill C-18, where the Trudeau government wanted to pitch this battle between the government and the people and against big tech. Now there are plenty of problems with big tech. You and I probably would agree, and you know that there are lots of problems there. But what's ended up happening here is that Facebook, that's Meta, and Google have basically said, look, we're not going to carry Canadian news. It won't be visible on these platforms like Instagram. And the government has said, well, we're doing this because big tech should pay their fair share. Now, I don't know what the fair share is. Nobody can define that, once again, just like no one can define what Canadian content is. So these are instances of government overreach, which has faced some pushback, yes, from the Bill C-11 actually faced considerable pushback, even from the likes of Margaret Atwood. Now, I don't think Margaret Atwood was necessarily a fan of the truckers' protest, and I don't necessarily see her as a conservative. I think she's very much a liberal. And so there was a lot of pushback, even from liberal circles. But all told, I mean, these things ended up becoming law, and so there was more government overreach. And what is also problematic is that any time there's any kind of dissent here in Canada, that anything where you're pushing against the official narrative, you know, people like Trudeau will immediately say that's misinformation, disinformation, and they smear you with those labels. And again, there's very little pushback from the legacy media. In fact, the people who are outraged by all of these labels are those of us who are independent. So to conclude, really, since the truckers' protest, which was this big event that to me represented some kind of an awakening of the Canadian mind and spirit, and that they were done with government overreach and censorship and you name it, we've had more of that since. And there was a public inquiry into the Emergencies Act that Justin Trudeau invoked to get rid of the protesters back in February of 2022. This inquiry went on for about 6 weeks or so. There was a lot of hope that this inquiry would shed a light on, once again, on government overreach and why it was so hugely problematic to invoke the Emergencies Act. But the judge presiding over the inquiry essentially concluded that misinformation and disinformation are very problematic. So we need more of the government involved in this, not less. So it was extremely, extremely disappointing. But there's been all kinds of pushback from sections of society that I would, that have come together on certain issues, like, for example, the teaching of gender ideology in schools across Canada. There have been lots of protests here over the last month and a half or so. I went to one big one here in Ottawa. And what was striking about it was the fact that conservative Muslim parents and conservative Christians and anybody who opposes gender ideology all got together and were said leave our kids alone, and essentially the Muslim constituency was a safe one for Justin Trudeau and the NDP, which is part of the ruling coalition. I mean, Justin Trudeau is basically in power because of Jagmeet Singh of the NDP, who the left of center party, which is basically propping his government up. And the Muslim Canadian constituency in Canada was a safe one for them. But that's not clear anymore, because those guys are saying, pardon my language, fuck Trudeau. So that's quite interesting to see. And I've interviewed some folks from the Muslim Canadian community, and they said, you can't take our vote for granted. We're not homophobic. We're not against gay rights. We're not against all of those things, but just don't try to indoctrinate our kids with pronouns and suggesting that they go on puberty blockers and that sort of thing. And we as parents have a right to be involved in our kids' lives, which seems rather fair and reasonable. So that's the state of Canada right now. And of course, Justin Trudeau is getting divorced. That was in the news last week. I'm not quite sure how that's going to play politically, but Ottawa's worst kept secret was that Trudeau and his wife had been living apart for years. So everybody knew that, but it's now become official. And so you know, and at the same time, his government keeps doubling down on any criticism of the government as misinformation and disinformation. So it's you know, we've had very little pushback against those things. And the good thing, I suppose, in all of this is that the opposition Conservative Party, the Tories, are actually polling quite well in the polls. So and so that gives me a sliver of hope that there's going to be finally some kind of a credible opposition, finally, because for the last couple of elections, that hasn't been the case. The Conservative Party was essentially ineffective and they couldn't do much there. But then I'm a little, you know, hesitant to come to any kind of conclusion, because as long as you have the NDP supporting Justin Trudeau, you know, they'll probably they could probably put together the numbers and they could probably come up with the numbers to stay in power even longer. And if that were to be the case, then that's going to be truly devastating for Canada.
I think that's a really useful outline about where Canada stands at the moment and the ups and downs, I guess, that you guys have experienced in the wake of the Canadian truckers protest. I mean, the thing that I really appreciated about the truckers protest, aside from the fact that I always like to see working class people standing up for themselves and their rights against a government that doesn't care very much about them, the other thing was that it did break the spell of Trudeauism for, I think, some people around the world. I mean, I was never under that spell. You were never under that spell either. But some people around the world were, of course. He was seen as the wokest of the woke, the nicest PM, a really swell guy. And then suddenly here he was, as you say, using the Emergency Act, an extraordinarily authoritarian piece of legislation against actual Canadian citizens who were just making their voices heard. And of course, we had the extraordinary incident, which I think will have long-term consequences, of an online platform refusing to give some of the funds that people raised for the truckers, refusing to give those funds to the truckers. And we've seen echoes of that in the woke banking controversy here in the UK, where we've had Nigel Farage and others being debanked or people being deprived their PayPal funds because they're not politically correct enough. So the kind of the long lasting impact of those decisions too, I think, is very important. But it's interesting to me who is rising up against Trudeau. So we had the Canadian truckers, and you mentioned there a group of people I want to ask you about, which is Muslim parents, Christian parents. You wrote a piece recently about these groups in society who are agitating against the teaching of gender ideology in schools in Canada. I find this new movement really interesting. We've seen it. I wrote about it in Newsweek in relation to the United States, because there's a similar development there where we've seen Latino parents, Armenian parents, Muslim parents, Christians gathering outside schools and saying, leave our kids alone. And it kind of blew up in England, in fact, in Birmingham here in 2019, when large numbers of Muslim parents gathered outside of school and said, you know, ditch the pride propaganda, essentially. There's something positive in that movement, isn't there? In the sense that it really is, firstly, it's embarrassing for leaders like Trudeau that the minority groups they so paternalistically claim to represent are now fighting back. But also these protests are cutting to the heart of one of the key ideologies in the woke movement, I guess, which is the gender ideology.
Yeah, absolutely. This one protest that I was at here in Ottawa back in June, what was striking about it was immediately was the fact that the counter-protesters really seemed to represent the ethnic diversity of Canada, right? You had Muslims, you had African Canadians, you had conservative Christians, you had South Asians, you had everybody from every walk of life. The counter-protesters, on the other hand, were just mostly white. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. The truckers' protest was also mostly white. Canada is a mostly white country, but the counter-protesters appear to be, in my opinion, very discomforted by the fact that the protesters weren't these usual people, like that they would expect, the like people from the truckers' protest. They're not far right extremists, as they're usually referred to, but in fact included many people of color, including socially conservative Muslims. And of course, you know, as you said, this doesn't fit into this progressive ideology. And, you know, it almost was like there was a sense of betrayal. You should have seen the meltdown on social media that, oh, we've stood up for the Muslim community, but they, you know, when we need them, they're not standing up for us on this issue. You know, so it almost seemed to suggest that the prize for supporting these minority causes was that, you know, those they supported should support them in return on the social issues that they cared about. But having said that, my problem is that when you bring religion into this, my concern is that it, you know, there's a danger that of, you know, there's a risk that, that there's going to be a regression on some of these things. On we built this consensus on things like gay rights. If you're a Muslim, conservative Muslim immigrating to Canada, you know this is what this, the, you know, that there are gay people in Canada. Gay marriage is legal, you know, and it's a fairly liberal country when it comes to one's sexuality or, you know, and that sort of thing that that go against the teachings of the Quran or go against Islamic doctrine. And so they've had to accept that as a fait accompli. And so when you're at the protest and when you see religion being invoked, like there were chants of Allahu Akbar, or the Christians were saying Christ is King. I mean, that's fine. I mean, that's their freedom of speech. I respect that completely. But I think that when you start bringing in religion into these kinds of movements, that's when I get a little concerned. And I think the criticism against gender ideology can happen without bringing in religion into the picture.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book. And I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now on with the show. Yeah, I think that's a really important point, and it begs the question of where the more reasoned political voices are saying, you know, this gender ideology is cranky and dangerous and it's confusing children. And in fact, it's harmful to the ideal of gay rights in the sense that it is, you know, often putting young lesbians, young gay men onto a conveyor belt of hormonal intervention and supposed medical correction. I mean, what we want, I think, are more of those kinds of voices making the case against trans ideology. I think in the absence of them, or given the weakness of them, there is a gap that is now being filled by religious voices who are saying, look, you've gone too far, leave our kids alone. But in relation to just sticking on this theme for one more moment, I want to ask you about what does this tell us a broader story? Because one of the real issues I have with the contemporary identitarian left or the woke left or the kind of politics that is really typified by Trudeau and many others in the Anglo-American Western world, one of the great problems I have with them is precisely the thing you mentioned there, which is this sense of ownership that they have of my minority communities, which means that I do think the clash between minority parents, whether they're Muslims or Latinos or African Americans or Jamaicans, whatever they might be, the clash between them and largely white liberals who thought that they owned them and who thought that these minority groups owed them a favor because we've been so nice to you, we've looked after you, we've pursued your interests, and now you owe us your obedience, is essentially what they're saying. The breaking down of that, do you think that holds out the possibility for a newer kind of politics, which is one that is based less on the racial idea and more on the idea that people should be free to think how they want on the big issues of the day?
Well, I mean, that's a great question, and it's a very important one. And the hope is that that's the direction which we're going. But you see, the hypocrisy, runs the other way too, right? Muslim Canadians, or any other minority group for that matter, will happily accept progressive support in combating what they perceive to be Islamophobia, for example. As long as that remains, and I don't see that going anywhere, I'm just not sure. Islamophobia, combating Islamophobia is a pretty big, it's a big enterprise here in Canada, and I'm sure it is in the UK as well. I mean, there's lots of money to be made. Everything is considered to be Islamophobic. I still don't know what that even means. I mean, criticizing the Bible does not make me, doesn't make me a bigot, but apparently if you criticize the tenets of Islam, that makes you a bigot. So I don't see, for example, not necessarily to single them out, but, I don't necessarily see Muslim Canadians saying, look, I think this Islamophobia thing has just gone too far. And, we reject that and everybody should be allowed to, express themselves freely, even when it comes to our religion. I just don't see such calls from the Muslim community, or for that matter, from any other minority group. So are we just going to get away from identitarian politics as a result of this? I do think that this is a turning point, I think, when it comes to an important component of the culture war. But as looking into the future, I think this is just going to be replaced by something else. I think it'll just be replaced by some other minority cause, and I don't see things changing all that much.
Yeah, I guess it's a good example of where there may be flashpoints and tensions in the strange contemporary coalitions that we have around the new ideologies. One of those coalitions being between white liberals and certain minority groups. There may be tensions and flashpoints there, but the question of whether it breaks down and is replaced by something more positive is a far larger political question. It's not the kind of thing that's likely to happen overnight or by accident. It will take a conscious promotion of a more equality-based, freedom-based politics. So I think watching these flashpoints is interesting, but expecting them to resolve every problem in society is probably going too far. I want to ask you just one more thing on Trudeau before we move on to a couple of other issues. You mentioned there that he's getting divorced. I'm not particularly interested in politicians' private lives. They can do whatever they want, marry, divorce, be straight, be gay. That's their own business. But he does strike me as a politician who lives off his personal morality and image a lot. I mean, this is a guy who is very much about the image, there's that famous image of him jogging, for example, or wearing politically correct socks and ties. And then you have this excruciating sight of liberal commentators in the UK and Europe and America gushing over him and his political clothing and his right-on messaging and his brilliant virtue signaling, which they think he does better than any other politician. Is there a danger for Trudeau in wrapping his prime ministership and his political journey up in his own personhood and who he is as an individual and the fact that he is good and right-on and right-thinking and so on? Is there a danger for him in that? That he comes to be seen not as a political creature, but as a kind of a creature of identity politics, I guess, who's more about signaling correct messages rather than making a positive impact on Canadian people's lives. How do Canadians view him politically in the broader sense?
Here's my impression of Trudeau. I don't think he's stupid. A lot of conservatives, for example, many of his critics who have this pathological hate for him, will say that he's stupid, but he's not stupid. I've actually seen him in live at this public inquiry that I mentioned to you early on into the Emergencies Act, and he was the final witness at the inquiry, where he presented himself for nearly 4 hours or something like that, where he was asked questions. He was grilled. He was, into why he invoked the Emergencies Act. And I have to say, I was very impressed. I mean, you can coach a person to some extent, but not, he was also thinking on his feet. At one point, I remember him correcting one of the lawyers. And so he's actually quite impressive. And this is the first time I've actually seen him, up close. So he's not stupid. He certainly, he's a savvy politician. There's no question about that. And he certainly uses his image. He's fit. He's tall. He's reasonably good looking. He's well dressed. So he's certainly used that to his advantage throughout. And I do think that he will always be associated with identity politics. There's no getting around it. He really seems to care about the trans issue. Like that's what animates his government more than anything. It's beyond me. I just don't understand that. And everything is trans related. So I don't know what's going on there, but at least the image of Trudeau that I've had over the last few months is that, he's doubled down on identity politics in a very big way. But mostly towards the trans stuff. There was this one interview where a Muslim parent asked him about gender ideology and it basically asked him, like, do you understand why we're protesting? And he said, no, this is, you're mistaken, my friend. It's misinformation, disinformation coming from the American far right. And he was basically telling this guy that he knows better than the Muslim community, and that he's just being misled. And there's no such thing happening in Canada. This is all a figment of your imagination that's being fed to you, or this is propaganda fed to you by the American far right. So I'm not quite sure what he's doing right now, like in terms of identity politics. He's certainly doubling down on the trans stuff, maybe because that's been in the news. That's the only thing that's been in the news recently. But, his legacy is going to be that of a prime minister who I think really took Canada back in a pretty significant way on a range of different issues. We're not even talking about the economy, which is its own thing. And this skyrocketing, the cost of living has gone up. People, every day there's a story of people who can't afford to pay their mortgage payments because interest rates have gone up and there are all of these distress sales. Yes, the economy is resilient, but people are not doing well. And you can see that. I live in the heart of Ottawa and homelessness has gone up, drug use has gone up, crime has gone up. These are issues that no one in his government really wants to address. They just keep passing the buck, but they keep doubling down on gender ideology, which just is complete. It's just perplexing. But he will be seen as someone who, in my opinion, really, put Canada on a very illiberal, and dark path. And it's going to take a lot for this country to come out of that. And it doesn't help, of course, that in the U.S. you have Joe Biden, who is, equally, if not more, doubling down on all of this stuff. So, they keep rubbing off against each other and really keep reinforcing this. So it's maddening, but yeah.
It's interesting that you say, we're not talking about the economy, and it's so true, especially for outsiders looking at a country like Canada. It was very similar with New Zealand when Jacinda Ardern was prime minister. People from outside would look at those countries and liberals would look at those countries and say, oh, Trudeau is so wonderful. Look what he's doing for trans rights. And look how nice he is to the Muslim immigrant family who just turned up. And then they would look at New Zealand and say, Jacinda Ardern, she's got the perfect female touch. She's a very caring politician. And there would be zero discussion about issues to do with the economy or people's sense of being in control of their lives or their political fate, the kind of things that politics should be about. And I guess that's another potential flashpoint as we all head into a cost of living crisis is how much longer can we sustain the kind of decadence of woke ideologies at a time when people are wondering how to make ends meet. So that will be an interesting clash too, I think. I want to come on to a story that you wrote for the Free Press, which is a really extraordinary story. And it touches upon a lot of the things we've just been talking about, a lot of the things that people like you and me are interested in terms of the new authoritarianism, the new politics of racialism, the new politics of accusation and demonization. All of this is wrapped up in this extraordinary and tragic tale concerning an educator in Canada called Richard Bilkstow. So why don't you just tell us the story, and then I've got a few questions as well that I want to ask you about it.
Thanks, Brendan. And yeah, this was probably one of the most difficult things I've had to work on. It was very painful, and it, it touched a chord with me. And anyway, the story is about the school principal. He was a beloved educator. His passion was always education, Richard Bilkstow. He loved teaching and mentoring. He dedicated his life to teaching kids and young adults who came from underprivileged backgrounds. He taught some of the most marginalized people out there. Not all of us get to live our dreams, but he actually got to live his dream as an educator. And he was so admired by his school students and admired by his peers. One person that I interviewed said, we were just walking in downtown Toronto, and people would just randomly come up to him and say, it's so great to run into you. You were one of the best teachers, one of the best principals I've ever had. That's how much he was loved. And he had a very long and distinguished career. He retired in 2019, but he loved teaching so much. He wanted to continue. He wanted to be engaged in that community. So he was hired as a supply principal as and when he was needed, and not because he needed the money, because he just really cared about education. He was hired as a principal at this adult learning center in Toronto and in 2020. And then they liked him so much that they just wanted him back for the fall of 2021. And he agreed, and things were going just fine, despite the pandemic, the lockdowns, the restrictions, school closures, and so on. But his life began to fall apart when there was a series of diversity, equity, inclusion training sessions that the Toronto District School Board, which is the country's largest school board, they had organized this in conjunction with this well-known DEI consultancy firm in Toronto called the Kojo Institute. And they were hired to train senior administrators in the Toronto District School Board. So that included principals, superintendents, vice principals, other senior officials, and so on. Richard went to it not because he had to, but he was always looking for, piecing together who he was as a person based on many conversations I had with friends and family. He went there because he was always looking to improve himself. He was always looking for to improve himself professionally that would help him do his job better. And the first session, which was April 19th, went without any incident. We don't quite know what was being said in that session. I don't have the audio recordings for that session, but things began to turn for him on the second session, April 26th of 2021, where the CEO of this institute, Kiki Ojo-Thompson, an African-Canadian woman, made these claims in the session saying that Canada is a bastion of white supremacy and that the racism that Black people in Canada experience in Canada is far worse than anything in the U.S. Richard got up And he said, sorry, I just want to just say this, but I just want to clarify. I want to push, basically he was pushing against her claim. And he said, look, I've taught some of the most underprivileged school kids in some very marginalized communities that includes teaching African American students. He taught in Buffalo, New York. He taught in the U.S. in the inner cities. And he said that that things are not so bad here. We have a socialized healthcare system. We have public school system, which generally works well. Everybody has access to it. It's very different from the U.S. So he says that, and Kiki Ojo-Thompson then reacts angrily, accusing him of white privilege, and saying that basically that he had no right to push against her claim because as a white person, he'll never understand what it means to be a black person in Canada. And, all he was doing was gently politely. And I provided the audio recordings of this interaction and more. So, listeners can, when they read the piece, they'll see the audio recordings, and they're more audio recordings, which were not embedded in our story, which is part of what in my tweet thread. So they can always go to my Twitter account and find those. And for the rest of the session, she just kept picking on him, kept referring to him as a resistor. At one point, she refers to him as a weed. And she said, I didn't know that my luck would turn out the way it did, but boy, I'm so glad that that this happened, and because I can show you exactly what a resistor is and what it looks like and what it sounds like. And so he just she was just dehumanizing him the whole way, and just kept bullying him and calling him referring to him as a white supremacist. And whiteness, that's another term that he was referred to as whiteness, not even by his name. He felt incredibly humiliated and traumatized, but he went back for the third session, where she continued doing this for about an hour and a half or so. And here what was different was she invites the audience in the Zoom session. There were about 200 people who are part of this training session. She invites them to refer to last week's session, refer to what happened last week. What does a resistor look like? What does it sound like? What are its tactics? So not even like referring to him as a person, he's just referred to as a thing at this point. And what was really hard to listen to were all of these people that he's worked with, as an educator. They all pile on him. They're all piling on him. They're calling him whiteness. Reinforcing the points that she's been making, that essentially calling him a white supremacist and a racist. And he was just absolutely devastated after this session. There was a fourth session that he didn't go to because he applied for sick leave, and he went on sick leave for 3 months because of the devastating impact it had on him mentally. He filed a workplace harassment complaint with the Workplace Safety Insurance Board, which investigated the matter and actually sided with him and said that the school board owed him money for the 3 months that he was on sick leave. So that should have given him a ray of hope. That should have given him, some comfort, knowing that things were, that at least with this Workplace Safety Insurance Board, they were on his side. He files a lawsuit earlier this year, and meanwhile he's been from the training session to when he died, all of the contracts, Brendan, that he had with the TDSB and, you know, all of the teaching contracts were canceled. For a substantial amount of money, but this is really not about money. It's about the principal. I reached out to school officials asking them why they reneged, why they just canceled his contract. I've not heard from anyone to this day. So his contracts were just canceled with no explanation. And he just became, everybody just distanced themselves from him. This is a man who spent 24, 25 years dedicating his life to teaching. He dedicated his life to teaching, and suddenly no one in that community, stood up for him in the end. And not a single person in that Zoom session pushed back against the bullying. In fact, they all became part of it and piled on him. So, I tried to piece together what must have happened to him the weeks before his death. One of the things that he was really terrified about was the, and this is based on conversations with his friends and family, and this kept coming up over and over again. He was really terrified that his lawsuit would be discovered by the legacy media, specifically one particular publication, the Toronto Star. And I think he had heard that a journalist from this publication had discovered the lawsuit and was going to write about it. He was absolutely terrified because he was terrified of being re-traumatized. And he didn't want to go through that again. And another publication got heard of the lawsuit, and they wrote about it favorably. So he was pleased with that, apparently. But he was—he knew that this other publication was still working on the story, and he was just—he hadn't been sleeping. He was just not the same person that he once used to be, he was just emotionally exhausted. His family tells me that I think the fact that their last name is so unique, and that Richard feared that, that name would be dragged through the mud. Knowing what they knew about about Richard, this is the kind of thing that he was not prepared to live with. It eventually got to him, and he killed himself, July 13th. And that was, basically what happened to him. But the story of his bullying and the pylon that he experienced, the education community that once praised him, as he was retiring, those very same people let him down. And that was most tragic.
If you're a regular listener to this show or a regular reader of Spiked, why not become a Spiked supporter? Spiked supporters is our thriving community of people who donate to Spiked. Anyone who gives £5 or more a month or £50 or more a year can become a Spiked supporter and get access to lots of exciting perks. Spiked supporters can comment on articles, get free and discounted tickets to events, get a discount on all items in our shop, and bookmark articles as you browse. This is our way of saying thank you to all of you who fund our work. Spiked is completely free, and yet you still hand over your hard-earned cash to make sure that anyone, anywhere can read us and listen to us. We're incredibly grateful for your generosity. If you don't give to Spiked yet, now is the perfect time to start. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to set up your donation and your Spiked supporters account. That's spiked-online.com/supporters. It's an extraordinary story. And when one reads your piece, it really does bring home the deranged nature of some of this new politics. I mean, there's one quote that leapt out at me in relation to one of the DEI sessions that he took part in, where the host of the session said to him, "You and your whiteness think you can tell me what's going on?" And it was, as you say, it's that kind of dehumanization that he experienced simply for asking a very polite question about whether Canada really is one of the most racist countries in the world. And then you describe really well, as you've just done there too, the Salem-like atmosphere that swirled around him as a consequence of him asking this question, where people who were his colleagues or his friends or his contacts for a period of time suddenly turned on him, pointed the finger at him, basically followed the instruction to treat him as a resistor slash witch slash, you know, unacceptable dissident, and just started to take part in that destruction of a man for daring to have an opinion. And then, as you say, it ends in the most awful way imaginable, because he feels he cannot take any more of this kind of pressure or this kind of demonization. And then he took his own life in July. I wanted to ask you, everyone should read the piece. It's very powerful and shocking. I wanted to ask you, has there been fallout from this in Canada? Has there been any form of self-reflection, not only amongst the newspapers that you mentioned, the Toronto Star or whoever, but amongst the kind of broader woke establishment, I guess, who very often turn a blind eye to this kind of demonization, or in fact take part in it? Has there been any fallout? Has there been any kind of reflection on the kind of politics that they've helped to promote, that something so obscene could happen as a result of a DEI witch hunt, essentially?
I'm afraid no. I think this institute, the Toronto District School Board, for example, their social media feed, they have turned off the replies. These brave, courageous educators shaping young minds of today can't even face up to, you know, can't even, you know, defend themselves on social media, on Twitter, or even just answer some basic questions. Kojo Institute protected their tweets until recently, and I don't know what they're doing right now. There was a protest of sorts a few days ago by the parents of Black kids or something. It's an organization where the CEO of this institute sits on that their board, and they came out defending her, and that this was all, that we were all a bunch of racists for talking about Richard Bilkestone. So this institute has a lot of influence. They're backed by some very powerful people in the government, in the provincial government, in the federal government. They've had you know, all kinds of contracts with places like the CDC and H&M and a whole bunch of different you know, well-known organizations. They have lots of money. They have a lot of clout. They have a lot of influence. They have a lot of powerful backers. So they're going to try to do, in my opinion, they're going to try to do as much as they can to try to, set the terms of this conversation. And you know what that would be like, what that would look like. We've not now, the minister in charge of education in the province of Ontario, where I live, where all of this happened, has promised an inquiry into the, into his death. The Toronto District School Board has announced an inquiry into what happened at the DEI session, and so those are good signs. But I'm, you know, I don't know how fair and objective these people are going to be. But having said that, you know, I have seen, at least, you know, based on what I've seen on social media, I've seen very little reaction from people in the legacy media, for example. A lot of people shared this obscene article in the Toronto Star last week, which was, again, trying to disparage him. And this is exactly what he was terrified about. He was very, very, and this journalist got a hold of the recordings, but did not make them public. And you have to wonder why, you know, if what you're claiming to be true, you should let the public listen to it. And which is what I did. I did not have the recordings, the original recordings. I recorded it while the lawyer played it for me. So I got big portions of that. And I was unable to get the original recordings for various reasons, but I felt it was important that everybody should listen to, should have an idea of who Kiki Ojo-Thompson is and what diversity inclusion training sessions look like, and the pushback and Richard's polite pushback against her claim. And, you know, and if when I first listened to it, I was horrified. You know, I had this uneasy feeling. It was just absolutely shocking. And I wanted everybody to hear that and, you know, and decide for themselves if they found this problematic. And so the fallout, I think, I mean, these announcements of an inquiry into his death are good. It's a good first step. But, you know, I don't know if if more people out there are questioning DI sessions, or are we once again speaking in an echo chamber here? That's always a concern that I have. But I'm hoping that even if people are not publicly agreeing with the story, or I'm hoping that they're at least privately saying that what happened was just unconscionable and this should never have happened.
Yeah, I think one thing I wanted to ask you in relation to the kind of discussion we might have about this at some point, if the media wakes up and takes an interest in these issues, in some ways the Richard Bilkestone tragedy is an extreme case because it involved a man taking his life, which is very extreme and incredibly tragic. But outside of that, in the less extreme situations, DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion policies still do play a very problematic role, don't they, in the academy, in workplaces, and so on. And it very often is geared towards a form of racial shaming, especially against white people or whiteness. You know, people are seen as the embodiment of whiteness. That's all a white man is, a white person is, in the way that racists in the past would have seen a black person as just an embodiment of blackness and the deviance that they would have associated with blackness. You see a rehabilitation of those old racist ideas in a new language directed at a different group of people. So there is a kind of this re-racialization of politics is really dangerous and destructive. And it strikes me that it's very interesting to me that no one on the left, even not many people on the traditional left, are speaking up about this, even though it seems clear to me that DEI has become one of the tools that bosses use in the workplace to divide and rule over people. It's one of the ways in which people are reprimanded at work or excluded from work or no platformed from certain positions and certain jobs because they hold supposedly problematic views. It's become very obvious, very obviously a tool of the new elites to control ordinary people. And there's very little pushback. So we do need a broader discussion, don't we? Even beyond this incredibly tragic case, we need a broader discussion about what DEI represents and why it's a problem.
Absolutely. So here in Canada, I don't know how things are in the UK, but here in Canada, there's a term that keeps coming up over and over again, given all of the stories that I've worked on recently, including this one. There's a culture of fear, culture of fear. I keep hearing that over and over again. And I'm actually very tired of hearing that term. I think it's a culture of cowardice. I think people are just not privately. I've come across people who will privately tell me, "Yeah, you know what happened is problematic, and it's tragic, and you know there needs to be change and so on." But no one wants to be part of that change. Nobody wants to stick their neck out. Nobody wants to go out there and say, "Hey, as a school principal, as an educator, as an official in the government, I think DEI training sessions are garbage. I honestly think they're garbage. I came to this country 25 years ago as a student, and I lived in some of the smallest towns in Canada, where even most Canadians have not even been there. And that was my first exposure to Canada as a person of color before I went to the big city 4 years after coming here. And there was no DEI training session. I didn't experience any racism. Sure, there are racists. There are racists everywhere. There are bigots everywhere. But, it was an incredible experience for me. And so I don't understand why. I mean, it's a grift, right? That's what this is. People are making money off this. A Kojo Institute made 81,000 Canadian for four sessions. That's a lot of money. For just spewing essentially garbage, you know, this part of the session, which I have not shared, which goes on this tirade about anti-Black racism. And it's just complete nonsense. I think at one point she says that, you know, Black people can never be racist. Then I'm thinking, Edie, I'm in, you know. And it doesn't occur to any of these educators to even like push against that basic factual error, right? And so there's a culture of cowardice. There's a culture of like, you know, where everyone is just too afraid of losing their jobs, their pensions, their homes for speaking out. And there are consequences for sure for sticking your neck out. I mean, you and I have experienced that. And, you know, I myself have been subject to cancellations and bullying and that sort of thing. And I'm not saying that everybody has to be like us, but here in Canada, especially this people are just so afraid of speaking out. Something's got to change at some point because the status quo is not sustainable. Let me tell you one thing. Richard Bilkestow was not a conservative. He was very much a progressive. He was on the left. He, in fact, believed in all of these things. He believed in equity, he believed in diversity, inclusion, and he believed in DI training sessions. So ideologically, he was not that far removed from the DI facilitators' way of thinking. But this was a case where even if you're basically on their side, it's all about 100% agreeing with that ideology. You cannot stray away from that, not even in the slightest bit, because then this is the kind of thing that ends up happening.
The other thing I was thinking in relation to this was you mentioned there that Richard was not a conservative. He was more of the progressive side. He was a bit of he was on the left and so on. I do think it's interesting that I think there is a coming to awareness on some sections of the left about the problem of this new politics. So if you look, for example, at the TERFs that we have here in the UK, we're often referred to as TERF Island because we have lots of trans critical, gender critical feminists. A lot of them come from the traditional left. They are people who cut their teeth in politics in the 70s and the 80s on the feminist left and the anti-racist left. And they are looking at some of this new stuff and thinking, this is regressive politics. This is censorious. It's misogynistic. It's really problematic. And I think there is a coming to awareness among sections of the left in the US as well. Susan Nyman's new book, for example, which is called The Left Is Not Woke. I had her on my podcast a few weeks ago. She makes a very interesting case, and I know lots of left-wing friends of mine who completely agree with it, that wokeness is not what the left was about for the whole of its existence until quite recently. Is there a similar dynamic in Canada? Is there any ripples of that? Or is the pushback against the things that you and I are worried about, is it coming just from conservatives, just from Muslim parents, or is there a broader constituency?
No, there is a broader constituency. I must say that I've been a small C conservative, practically my whole life. These same people that, you know, were essentially agreeing on all of these things, we probably would not have agreed on many things 10 years ago. But that's changed, and it's fascinating to see that. And these are people who were on the left. I think they still consider themselves to be on the left, but the sensible left, not this crazy radical progressive nonsense that we're seeing today. And so that gives me a lot of hope, but I don't know what that means ultimately. You know, I just don't know how big that is. Let's take gender ideology as an example. You have countries like Sweden, which was the first country to provide transgender care, I think, back in the 70s. they put a stop on things like puberty blockers. And you have countries like Norway, Sweden, the UK, a range of different countries that have actually, the medical community has examined this issue. They've decided, look, I think we should just put a stop to this right now, or at least keep these things at a research or at a trial level. And I think we've gone too far with this. That's been the conclusion over the last few months. Here in Canada, we've had nothing like that from the medical community. In fact, not a single word. The Conservative Party has also weighed in on the gender ideology debate. They've just stayed away from it. When, in fact, I think it's one of the most important parts of the culture war. And if you're seen as remaining silent, I think politically it's something where they could. This is a winning issue for them, as far as I'm concerned. But again, cultural political correctness, or just maybe cowardice, whatever it is that's going on here in Canada, we're not seeing that kind of opposition to this stuff. We're not seeing the medical community talking about saying, you know, I think we should pause puberty blockers. We're not seeing that, and so. So yes, I mean, it's good to see that the traditional left, you know, and I would not have seen eye to eye with them on so many different things. We're all basically agreeing on the same thing right now. That's heartening. But I think eventually change is going to happen, has to happen politically. As long as you have the government, and this is not just the Liberal government, it's not just the Justin Trudeau government, it's also the Conservative governments in this country, the provincial governments, haven't taken a position on this. They've just looked the other way when it comes to important issues like gender ideology and like DEI, for that matter. The Conservative government of Ontario, in fact, has hired this institute for their DEI training sessions. So where exactly is the resistance coming from? So you have people standing up against this. You have Muslim Canadians saying enough is enough. But I don't know how that's going to translate politically, because that's, for me, that's where change is eventually going to have to come about. As long as you have governments pouring money into these things, that's where they make their money, the likes of Kojo Institute. And once that, you know, that dries up, where are they going to go?
Rupa, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brendan.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.